All right, thank you for that introduction, Luca, and thanks for having me here. Wow, this is a very bright light. Well, it's been 100 years since Albert Einstein gifted us his magnificent theory of general relativity. And in all that time, there hasn't been one single observation, give or take a cosmological constant, that's been in conflict with his theory. And that's kind of disturbing, actually, because we know that gravity is quantized, and we should have seen some kinds of, we should know that there are also higher derivative corrections in principle. And so from a theoretical point of view, it's sort of very disappointing that we don't have anything more, we don't have any deviations a century later. So what I'd like to tell you about today are some ideas about how you might have an observational evidence of the quantization of gravity. So what could we? What are the things we could observe? Well, we don't observe gravity directly, right? We can't measure the metric. It's not even gauge invariant. But what we do measure typically are the behaviors of things falling in GR. So of freely falling objects, and that could be the time-like geodesics of precessing. Mercury, the time-like geodesics of receding galaxies, or maybe the null geodesics of light bending around the sun. So a natural thing to study is the behavior of geodesics, because that's how we probe gravity. And so today I want to tell you about how those geodesics might behave in the presence of a quantum of the quantization of this of gravity. And when I say quantization of gravity, let me be clear here. I'm not going to rely on a UV complete theory, so it doesn't matter whether that completion is string theory or loop quantum gravity or whatever. We won't have any holography here. We're just going to treat the metric as a quantum field and quantize it and see how far we go. Okay, so a key concept is, one second, this is the wrong, I think this is not the right slide. Hold on a second. One moment. I'll make sure that this is yes, this is it. Okay, this is the one I did today. But strangely, it's not showing this picture. Huh? You see that? There's the picture of LIGO disappeared. So this is a yeah maybe. We can't measure individual geodesics, and nothing's going to happen to those because by the equivalence principle. But what we can look at are geodesic deviation vectors. A classic concept is the idea of geodesic deviation. And so imagine here you have two free-falling massive objects, M and M naught, and they have some separation xi. And the kind of thing that we might measure is their deviation. And that's exactly what LIGO measures, or LISA more generally, because you have these two mirrors, which are 40 kilogram mirrors that are essentially in free fall. They're not free falling vertically, but they're free to move other ways. As a wave, gravitational wave passes by, that distance can fluctuate, and that's what we're measuring. So measurement of the geodesic deviation vector is really what we're doing at gravitational wave detectors. Oh, here it is then.
Here it is.
This is an example. These are the two masses, the mirrors at the end point, at the end of an arm. The arm has length xi, and that xi fluctuates as a gravitational wave passes through. And the equation that describes this is one of the key equations of general relativity, is a geodesic deviation equation. Here it is. And you can see that the space-time geometry comes in here in the Riemann tensor. In the case of a gravitational wave, the Riemann tensor takes this form. And so schematically, if I put this in there, I get that equation obeys this. The geodesic deviation obeys this kind of equation. All right, so that was for a classical, that was for classical particles moving in a classical background. Now the question we want to ask is, what is the generalization of this equation when the space-time metric is treated as a quantum field? I should say one thing, that a few years ago I gave a talk at this Copernicus webinar, and I just realized recently that perimeter was part of that. So some of you may have seen, those of you around at that time may have seen some of the early slides here, but I added a lot of new material. So bear with me if you recall that talk from 4 years ago. But anyway, so the question we set out to answer is, what is the, how do we extend this equation to the case of quantum, when the geometry is quantized?
Sorry, you mean that the full metric is quantized or just perturbations around the classical background?
We're going to treat things perturbatively in linearized quantum gravity.
Right, so not when the space-time metric is quantized. You're going to ask the question, what happens to this equation when
in the context
around the
that's right. That's right. So it's going to be quantum. It's going to be perturbative. There's not even going to be interactions. It's going to be free linear quantum theory, quantum gravity. Okay. So precisely this question was I studied with my collaborators here from this is Frank Wilczek, and that's my former postdoc George Zahariade, who's now faculty in Krakow, Poland. And we wrote a series of papers. We wrote an essay which got the Gravity Prize, and also a PRL and a PRD. So in increasing order of detail, you can read them as you go down if you want to follow it more. And our starting point was, we started in first principles. We said, let's write down the action for gravity coupled to two particles, right? And we want to look at what happens to the equations of motion of the separation when you quantize this metric here. So it's Einstein-Hilbert action plus the action for two free-falling particles. We can use Fermi normal coordinates and put one of them on a classical trajectory. We'll put that as a, you know, at our origin. And then the other particle is then at some point t xi. Okay, so I'll just show you some details, but then we'll take away the big picture again. So if we insert the metric in Fermi normal coordinates, here's Fermi normal coordinates, which is the business end of this. I guess it's easier to use this side. And then we insert into the particle action and expand the square root, which we can do in a non-relativistic limit. Then we get two terms like this. Okay. So all I did was in this g mu nu here, I inserted the Fermi normal coordinates, and then I expanded. Square root. Okay. Furthermore, we can then take the gravity part, the metric part, and expand in Fourier modes. We expand in perturbations and then write those in Fourier modes. And then if we do that, this is what we get. Now there's an expansion. K is the wave vector and S is the polarization. There are two polarizations of a graviton. And this is our action. Okay. And just to indicate how simple this action is, I've focused on a single mode. And here's what it looks like if there's just one mode. Okay, so this is a simple harmonic oscillator, okay, a free particle, and a cubic interaction. And in this expression, m naught is the mass of the second particle. Okay, we put the first one at rest. M naught is the mass of the second particle. Okay, xi is the geodesic deviation of the two particles. Okay, the two, and which you, since we put one particle at the origin, xi is effectively the coordinates of the second particle. Okay, so that's what this means here. Omega is the amplitude, is the frequency of the mode that we're considering. Q is the amplitude of that mode. Okay, so each mode has an amplitude. M is not a meaningful concept. I've just put an M in there for dimensional reasons. It depends on the size of the universe that you put it in, but it will drop out of all calculations. So it's just there to make this look like a simple harmonic oscillator. And then this G here contains these constants here, and this is a Yukawa type interaction. It's a little tricky. There are two derivatives, okay, but it's still not that bad. Okay, why are there two derivatives? Because it comes from the Riemann tensor, which has two derivatives. Okay, so this is the form of the action. And the key thing about this action is that regardless of the fact that that there are derivative couplings here, this is a very simple action since both Q and Xi are no more than quadratic. Okay, it means that we can solve this not just perturbatively, but we can actually fully solve this in quantum theory. We can fully quantize this theory. Okay, so here's then our approach. We're going to treat both the deviation, or Xi, or the second particle, or the mirror, however you want to call it, Xi, and gravity quantum mechanically. Okay, we're going to at first take the second particle, the mirror. I'll use mirror second particle detector arm length equivalently. We're going to treat that quantum mechanically too, even though it's a 40 kilogram mirror. And in the end, we're going to take a classical limit. But at first, we're going to treat everything quantum mechanically before we take a classical limit. And then we're going to integrate out gravity. And by integrating out gravity, we're going to be left with an effective dynamics of the remaining degree of freedom, which is the particle. Okay? So how do we do that? Well, suppose the gravitational field is initially in some state xi. We don't know what the final state of the field is. Okay, why not? Because the gravitational field and the particle are interacting. The particle picks up energy from the wave, you know, so by, you know, it starts moving as the wave passes through. And so in general, there's some interaction. After it stopped moving, it's emitted gravitons or whatever. We don't know what the final state of the field is as a result. Okay, and what we'd like to calculate is if the particle is originally in state A. State A, you could imagine to be any quantum state. For example, it could be a position eigenstate. You can say the particle is initially here. Okay, you could have a roughly normalized position eigenstate peaked around some spot. And position B might, state B might be some other position state, or whatever. It can be any states you want. We want to calculate the probability that a particle goes from A to B in the presence of a gravitational field that was initially in state psi, but whose final state we don't know. So how do we do that? Well, the initial state of the wave of the mode was xi, and of the particle was A. The final states are B and F, some final state. We don't know what F is, so we're going to sum over our final states. Since this is a probability, we're going to square it. And in between, there's some time evolution operator, U. And that's, since we have the Lagrangian, we have the Hamiltonian, and therefore we know what this U is. Okay, so this can be calculated. And amazingly, this can be calculated exactly. Okay, and here's the answer. All right, which I promise you we won't need again. But it can be done. I just wanted to show you that it can be done. And I'll just sort of read out what we get. So the probability, first of all, it depends on what there's a piece here that depends on what the wave functions are of the particle, the initial and final states. Then there's a double path integral, okay? Why is it a double path integral? That's because of the probability, right? There's the initial action for the Lagrangian for the particle, okay? It's in here. There's a minus one here because the probability includes the complex amplitude and the amplitude complex, the amplitude times the complex amplitude. So there's a minus, the IA over H bar becomes a minus for the other one when you write it in the path integral form. Then there are some other pieces. And these pieces, when you do have interpretations, there's going to be an autocorrelation function, there'll be a noise term, and there'll be a dissipation term. Okay? So here's the takeaway, that there's an auxiliary piece which looks like a noise term. Okay? That where did this come from? It came from, it's sort of a dummy. There's a trick called the Feynman-Vernon trick, which basically takes an exponential and writes it as an integral over a Gaussian. So there's a new, so any exponential, okay, I can pretend is the result of doing a Gaussian integral. So I have an, additional auxiliary dummy variable, and that's this Gaussian integral here. Okay.
I have a question.
Sorry. Yes.
You wanted to show this to say that this is exact, but I wanted to understand in which sense it is exact. So you're having the field H, right? So you're assuming that there are some gravitational waves on the background?
Yes. So it's exact within the context of linear of the theory that I'm working with, which is linearized quantum gravity.
Okay.
It's not exact in that there are, of course, other corrections to that theory, which are just thrown away.
Okay, so there's okay. G Newton correction.
Yes, yes.
And in H bar, on the other hand, it is exact.
Exactly. I mean, yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So we can now take the classical limit of the geodesic deviation, the classical limit of xi. So here's some horrible expression. Now we're going to take the saddle point. Okay, so taking the classical limit means taking the saddle point. And what we get is this. Okay, so I want to just, this is the takeaway here. And the idea here is that this is our geodesic deviation xi. And this is the equation of motion it obeys. And there are now three pieces. So this is the extension of what used to look like this. Okay, so this was the original form, and which is still there. But now there are two extra pieces. This fifth derivative piece is a radiation reaction piece that you would have even classically. You've got the wave and the particle interacting with each other, just like in E&M where you have an Abraham-Lorentz force that comes from these interactions of the electromagnetic field with charges. You would also have that. We're going to discard this, throw this away for simplicity. But in addition, there's a quantum noise term. And that noise term has a subscript psi because its properties, its statistical properties, depend on the state of the gravitational field. So this equation is no longer an ordinary differential equation because this is a random function. Okay, and so this is now a stochastic equation. It's a Langevin-type equation. And how did it turn into a stochastic equation? Well, we started out with two quantum objects, and we took a classical limit of one of them. Okay, so if you have a classical system that is coupled to a quantum system, the probabilistic nature of that quantum system is inherited by the classical system in the form of a stochasticity. So that's a very general feature, and that you if you couple a quantum system to a classical system, the classical system is going to become noisy. Okay, so that's what happens here, and we get a noisy behavior. Okay, so the geodesic deviations will now have random fluctuations. And we can compute the properties of n. What is n? N is just a random function. So n doesn't have to itself to have any meaning. But what does have meaning is the statistical properties of n. What is the autocorrelation function? What is the variance of n? And so on. Okay. So all of those are calculable for from xi. And we could calculate them explicitly for a variety of states, like the vacuum state, thermal states, coherent states, squeeze states, and yeah. So here's schematically what it looks like. You have the whirl lines of two particles, and this would be, and in the presence of a classical gravitational wave, this is what would normally happen, that the geodesic deviation would vary as a classical wave passed through. However, now, thanks to thanks to the fact that we have this random function, we now have this kind of behavior, this sort of noisy behavior. Okay. So this is what we call the noise of gravitons. You can think of it heuristically as the reason it's happening is that the particle these mirrors are being bombarded by gravitons. But that's just a phrasing. I mean, what we did was we quantized the gravitational field. So the main message is the signal of quantum gravity is in the noise. Okay. So in LIGO, they make a big fuss about, you know, they get rid of all the noise because they want to look at the astrophysical signal. But for us, the most interesting thing is actually the noise. And I find that very poetic in the sense because it's, you know, LIGO has taught us so much, gravitational waves have taught us so much about the universe, but they have a chance to teach us about gravity itself, about quantum gravity. Historically, yes.
Could you make a similar argument for electromagnetism?
Yes.
Like that? So if,
that's right.
So you could do something like that and try to guess what's the quantum nature of electromagnetism by looking at it.
That's right. That's right.
Question?
Yes.
Are you sure that this is seeable? Because, for example, there are theorems that tell us that if you want to detect a graviton moving in a simple Friedmann-Rabin Walker universe, you won't be able to see on the order of one gravitons before the universe collapses.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a famous paper by Freeman Dyson that says that you could never hope to observe a single graviton. And that's true. It's not exactly a theorem, but maybe it's, you know, the limits of, and in a way it makes sense, right? We've only barely detected gravitational waves, classical gravitational waves. And if you estimate the in a classical gravitational wave, there are about 10 to the 37 gravitons per cubic wavelength of the gravitational wave. That's a simple calculation from the energy density. And so to measure one graviton, it would look like we would have to have 37 orders of magnitude improvement in our already amazing LIGO before we could detect that. And that may be true, but the key thing is we don't actually have to observe single gravitons to detect their presence. And a famous example of that is, analogy of that is Brownian motion. So if you think about what Brownian motion is, we have a dust grain or pollen grain suspended in water. And if you watch it, it starts doing a random walk. And the reason it's doing a random walk is it's being bombarded by discrete objects, by molecules. But we can't measure the effect of a single collision with a molecule. But we can still measure their cumulative effect, and we can even see it with your naked, with very simple, crude telescope microscopes, that there's random walk. So just as that Brownian motion allows you to see infer the existence of the discreteness of matter of molecules, similarly here the collective behavior of this that's of gravitons, which is encoded in this noise, will is a clue to the quanta discreteness of space-time, of gravity. I should say that historically the study of noise has played a very important role in physics. It was Penzias and Wilson who looked at the unexplained noise in the radio receiver to infer the existence of CMB. Of course, Einstein and Smoluchowski explained the existence of molecules correctly understanding Brownian motion, and even the existence of quasi-particles and the fractional quantum Hall effect was seen first as Schott noise and electrical signals. Okay, so this looks like the right way to study it. I now want to tell you a little bit about some extensions of this work, and this is done with these following collaborators. Sudipta Sarkar here is faculty in India at IIT Gandhinagar. The rest of them are all grad students at ASU, except for Rafaela, who's a postdoc there. So one question is the noise detectable? So in order for the noise to be detectable, we'll need two things. First of all, its spectrum should be distinguishable from other sources of noise. There's lots of noise in LIGO, right? There's thermal noise, there's photon shot noise from the laser, there's electronic noise in their devices, in their instruments, there's seismic noise from a truck passing by, and so on and so on. So we need to be able to say, well, this is the distinguishing feature of this noise. And of course, its amplitude better not be too small. If it's just fluctuating by a Planck length, we're never going to see that. So the good news about the noise spectrum is that it's exactly calculable for many classes of quantum states. This is the power spectrum that we obtained. The vacuum one looks just like that. And that's very, but the interesting thing here is that if you choose a squeeze state, there's and with a squeezing parameter R, you get an exponential enhancement in the amplitude of the noise. And I'll say more about squeeze states later. We can also consider two separated detector arms. So LIGO has just two arms like this, but imagine that you have two arms that are, would be a new kind of device. You have a gravitational wave arms in different places, okay? And since our noise originates directly from the source, both arms will detect the same noise. They are both going to see the same gravitational field. And therefore, there's quantum gravitational. This quantum gravitational noise is correlated across detectors. So that makes it very different from photon shot noise. If you have a photon shot noise in this arm and you have photon shot noise here from the lasers, those are just uncorrelated, right? Similarly, if there's thermal noise, that will also be uncorrelated. So this noise is correlated across detectors. And this is what I studied with my PhD student, Francesco Setti. And we looked at that correlation, and we said, well, if there's a detector of length xi naught, and there's another arm here that we're measuring of length rho naught, and they're separated by capital L, then we found this kind of correlation, and here's the result. And if we look at this result, we notice two things. First of all, not surprisingly, as the detectors get further and further apart, the correlations die down dramatically because it goes as 1 over L to the fourth. So they really need to be close to each other in order for there to be correlated. That's not surprising. And then there's an interesting angular dependence. And if you plot this function here, you see that the correlation becomes 1 when the two detectors are aligned, when the detector arms are aligned, their fluctuations are perfectly correlated. And it goes to 0 at when the angles are when this 3 cos squared theta minus 1 is 0, which happens at an angle of 54.7 degrees. So that suggests an experiment to isolate quantum gravitational noise. We should consider 3 arms. Okay, we're measuring the length of these arms with lasers, and we're looking at the fluctuation, the noise in those the noise in those lengths. Okay, and if we find correlated noise across all 3 detectors, okay, then it's not quantum gravitational noise, because the quantum gravitational noise correlation should go to 0 at this angle of 54.7 degrees. On the other hand, if we find that 2 of them are correlated and the third one is not, there's no correlated noise between this one and this one, that would be a telltale sign that this is quantum gravitational noise. So this is a way to distinguish this kind of noise from the many other kinds of noise that won't have these features. Okay, what about the amplitude? Well, we can estimate the magnitude of the noise, so that would be the variance of the fluctuation. And that's the integral of the noise power spectrum times the length of the arm squared. So the noise power spectrum is actually divergent, but we can put a cutoff on it, which has to do with the maximum detector sensitivity. Okay, so we'll call that omega max. And this power spectrum, as I said, depends on the state of the gravitational field. So if we choose a vacuum state or a coherent state, then we find that delta L over L is hopelessly small. Okay, that is really, really, really tiny. And we'll never measure that. On the other hand, if there are squeeze states, and this is our only hope, or our best hope at least, then there's an exponential enhancement. And so if there's a even a modest, well, maybe if we have R around 60 or 40, or actually I think we need it only to be around 40, then we would already be able to see this at LIGO. Okay, and so nature has to be kind enough to give us a gravitational field in a squeezed state. Okay, I'll come back to why or how that might happen. Okay, so let me summarize what I have so far. There could potentially be observable quantum gravitational noise from quantum fluctuations of the metric, and it could be observable provided that the quantum state of the gravitational field is very far from a coherent state. Example is squeezed state. Okay, so let me have a little bit of, I'm going to have a little discussion. Are there any questions? Yes.
For the squeezed state, should the gravitational field be very strong to have a strong squeezed state?
Yes. Yeah. But only needs to be strong when the field is produced. It doesn't have to be strong here. Okay. When the state is produced. So first of all, what's happening here? Shouldn't quantum gravity be nearly impossible to observe? There's this kind of lore that says that quantum gravity really manifests itself in regions of extreme curvature. Okay. And here I am talking about quantum gravity effects on Earth, right? Which is about as close to flat as it can get. And also, why should the gravitational field be in a squeezed state? Let's consider these issues. So about the first one, it is true that if you want to look at loop effects, those really only matter at very high curvature. But loop effects are not the only way we can tell that a field is quantized. Right? In fact, even there are tree-level phenomena that indicate quantization. How so? Well, let's ask the same question for electrodynamics. How do we know that the electromagnetic field is quantized? Okay, if I ask you, how do you know there are photons? So, well, you could point to loop calculations like the lamb shift, right? But there are actually many, many other effects that are impossible to explain using Maxwell's equations, using classical E&M, that we've observed, and none of those involve any loop effects. Okay? Example, photon anti-bunching, entangled photon, subpotentiation statistics, Compton effect. Many of these are sort of bread and butter effects in quantum optics. Okay? And the key thing is that they're all tree-level effects in a state that has no classical counterpart. So in other words, here's the takeaway. If you have a quantum state that does not look like a classical state, okay? Well, what do I mean by classical state? I mean a coherent state. Coherent states look like solutions to the classical field equations, okay? So if I have a state that is far from being a coherent state, there can be tree-level effects that you could not explain using classical physics. Okay, so if you have, you know, for example, a single photon Fock state, there's no solution of Maxwell's equations that corresponds to one photon, because it's just not a solution. It's a Fock state of one. It's not a coherent state. It's not just a very weak electric field. Okay, it's an eigenstate of the number operator. So such states don't have any counterparts, and the same is true for gravity. There could be potentially observable states that don't require super high curvature, that don't require extreme curvature, that are potentially observable and distinguishable from solutions of Einstein's equations, provided the gravitational field is not a coherent state. Okay, so now the question, all important question, is how do we get, what could cause the gravitational field to not be in a coherent state? So let me tell you a little bit about coherent states and squeezed states in case there's a refresher. If we have a field, let's say a scalar field phi, and you couple to a classical source J, so then there's an interaction Hamiltonian J phi, and then you quantize the field phi schematically as A plus A dagger, Okay, you can do this in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory. Then, and if I look at an interaction picture, if I have originally some vacuum state, and then this interaction is turned on, this J is turned on and off for a little bit, so my state evolves via the interaction Hamiltonian in this way, or maybe some time-ordered product of this. And now plugging in A plus A dagger here and ignoring the A, which kills the vacuum, I get something like this. Okay, and this is a coherent state. A coherent state is a state where you have the exponent of the creation operator. Okay, so this is a very general way in which if you just have any source coupled linearly like this, you're going to produce coherent states. Okay, on the other hand, if you had this kind of unusual coupling, where the coupling is not J phi like we normally couple sources, but J phi squared, and now I expand phi in terms of A plus A dagger. There are also other terms, but importantly, there's a term A dagger squared now. And this is what's called a squeeze state. So if you have this kind of interaction, okay, you will naturally produce squeezing, or at least a state that doesn't look like a coherent state. And the good news is that gravity naturally produces these things. Gravity automatically has interactions like this. How do we see that? Well, let's take our metric and let's expand it around some non-trivial background. Okay. Then the Einstein-Hilbert action expanded this way is there's a background part, there's the fluctuation part, and then because there's a background, often we take this to be Minkowski space, but if we didn't, we would have a coupling to a Riemann tensor like this. The Riemann tensor off the background. And if I look at this object and I compare it to that, okay, our Riemann tensor is like J. Okay, it's some background Riemann tensor. And the field that we're quantizing is H, like phi here. So that's exactly the thing that we want. There's a coupling, quadratic coupling interaction term here. Okay. So wherever this Riemann tensor is significant, that's where we're likely to produce. If we have this Riemann tensor briefly switched on in a significant way, that's going to produce squeeze states in gravity. So it's automatic. And so the best place for that might be things like black hole mergers, other strong gravitational field situations where the states that you're producing from them, even though it's all classical, are not describable. Well, it looks sort of classical, but when you quantize it, the classical perturbation the classical geometry will produce a squeeze state. Okay, and this is work with my student, my postdoc, and Frank in progress. Okay, how much time do I have?
10 minutes.
Perfect. Okay, so I'll just now tell you. So this was the main result, and I just want to tell you some extensions, mainly focusing on the second one here. So there are quantum gravity corrections to Newtonian freefall and also quantum Ray Chaudhuri equation. So let's just look at Newton's law. So in our derivation, we considered flat space with some fluctuating metric, and we looked at how the geodesic deviation was affected by that, and it became noisy. We could do the same thing, not in flat space, but where there's a Newtonian background, where there's a Newtonian potential. So we can redo the same calculation. You've got the geometry is not just Minkowski space, but there's a little Newtonian background, and then there's some quantum perturbations around that, and we're looking at the geodesic deviation between the Earth and the falling object, okay, which is its height. And if you do that, we worked it all out. Most of these things aren't doing anything. And again, there's a noise term here, which turns this into a stochastic equation. And if in the case where this is a weak field gravity, which is like, you know, where the potential is mgz, this is what we get. This term here is from 1966. From 1666, this is. This is the special relativistic correction. This is a general relativistic correction, and then finally there's a quantum gravitational correction. So I'm very happy with this. and one of the nice things about this, which is sort of surprising, is that the M's all cancel, right? And so it's not surprising that the M's cancel up to here, because the cancellation of the M's is what's, you know, is what gives us the equivalence principle. You know, that was Galileo's famous experiment that shows that things fall independent of M. But even in quantum gravity, the M's cancel. And so it's sort of as if there's still a kind of equivalence principle even when you consider quantum gravity. And so maybe one way of thinking about it is that each of these fluctuating metrics is another space-time, in the, literally in the many-world sense. Right? There's actually a world with a different geometry in the many-universes sense. And in each one of them, it's doing a free fall, which therefore obeys a geodesic equation and doesn't have an M in it. And so that's why when you sum over them all, the M's will still drop out. Okay, what I really want to tell you about, partly because Luca has been so interested in this, is in the quantum Ray Chaudhry equation. So we've already looked at the deviation of a pair of geodesics. That was a geodesic deviation equation. And so now it's natural to consider a whole congruence of geodesics. We consider a congruence of geodesics. The behavior of that will tell us about the quantum Ray Chaudhry equation. And so we wrote two papers on this. The time-like one is a straightforward extension of the work I just described from a pair of geodesics to a bundle of congruence of geodesics. But I want to tell you about the null one because that's a little bit different. And so before we can talk about that, we're going to have to rederive this result for null geodesics. Okay. So null geodesics are quite different. So let me just tell you how that goes. We're going to look at, again, Einstein-Hilbert action coupled to two null particles. So even writing down the action there, you have to be careful. You have to write down an Einbein, and then you can put one of them on shell and then look at the separation to the other one. And in order to do that, you have to use these null Fermi normal coordinates. These were only discovered relatively recently in the 90s, I think. And when you do that, you get basically this kind of equation for this kind of action for the second particle with a geodesic deviation xi. And importantly, if you follow it all through, the geodesic deviation xi lives in a codimension 2 hypersurface. That's very characteristic of null congruences. Next, we're going to quantize the metric as before. And now, this would be the equation of motion, the geodesic deviation equation. And what we're going to do is we're going to promote it to an operator equation. So if we work in Heisenberg picture, the classical equations of motion are obeyed by the operators, the quantum operators. So we're just going to do that and turn everything into an operator. And this Riemann tensor here is made up out of this object here. And so that becomes an operator too. And this and you can write this in this way in terms of this noise tensor. This noise tensor is just is just made up out of derivatives of this. And so you got a k squared, and this is how it looks like if you do a mode expansion. And S is the polarization, k is the wave vector. Okay, so we want to solve this equation, this operator equation. That's not so easy to do, but what we can do is we can solve it perturbatively. We're going to just, each one of these noise tensors, noises basically contains a h-bar, or each one of these, so we're going to do an expansion in h-bar, or equivalently, an expansion in the noises. So we plug this into both sides of here and compare order by order in the noise. So the leading term here, you'll just have this equation with zero on the right-hand side. And so that's going to be xi double dot equals zero, which is the classical equation of motion of a particle that's just sitting there, right? Newton's second law with no force. And then plug that in here again. You'll get an equation xi 1 double dot is equal to n times xi 0, and so on. Okay? Okay, so that's how we would go about solving those equations. So now consider a congruence of geodesics. So we're going to consider a rectangular congruence. Okay, so imagine that there's a whole bundle of light rays, or you can imagine a torch, flashlight that has a rectangular opening instead of a round opening. And so the light rays that come out from that rectangular beam, they are all moving, let's say, in the z direction, and this would be a cross section of them. Okay, so there's one, this is a spatial space diagram, not space time. They're all moving, and all the light rays are going in the z direction, and here's our beam section of our beam. Okay, and so if we now consider a reference geodesic at the origin, that's a null geodesic at the origin, and we ask, what is the area of our beam, cross-sectional area of our beam? We can think of that area as, it's a rectangle, so it's length times width, right? And what's the length? It's the length, it's the geodesic deviation to the furthest geodesic here. And what's the width? It's the geodesic deviation from this reference geodesic to this other furthest geodesic in that perpendicular direction. So the area of our beam of our is actually the product of the geodesic deviations. Okay. And that's very interesting because the geodesic deviations, they're stochastic, but they're correlated. Okay. The reason they're correlated is that every mode of the, so if I have a gravitational fluctuation, those fluctuations are transverse traceless. So if they expand in one direction, they will expand in one direction, they will contract in the other direction, right? So that's what gravitational waves do. They expand in one direction, contract in another direction. So if you look at xi might go to 1 plus n, where this is some fluctuation, and eta will go as 1 minus n. And if you take the product of xi and eta, you're going to see that there's a 1 minus n squared, okay, which is always negative. Okay, so the average of the area, the expectation value of the area, is related to the variance of the for the n's. Okay, that's because the area is the product of the geodesic deviation. So in particular, we can calculate it. These calculations are for the particular state, which is a vacuum state, okay, which is chosen the usual Poincaré invariant vacuum. And if we do that, we find this kind of expression. Xi naught, eta naught are the initial sizes of the beam, and then there's a, and then importantly, there's a lambda to the fourth. Lambda is a UV cutoff. Okay. What is lambda? Well, one natural choice of what lambda might be is the actual size of the system. So if there are quantum fluctuations that are much smaller than the size of the system, we'd expect those to wash out. But it's only the long wavelength quantum fluctuations which will affect both the geodesics on either side equally, and therefore cause there to be a change in the size. So we expect there to be a UV cutoff based on the size of the system. So that's lambda. And then from this, you can calculate the quantum contribution to the area, which is the quantum contribution of this. And that's what this is. And as I said, it's going to have a negative sign. And then finally, we can take its derivatives to find the expansion parameter theta, which is like so. And we find that this quantum expansion is generically negative, and in particular for the case of the vacuum state, this is what we get. Okay.
Sorry, what is omega c?
Where's omega c?
The last.
Oh yes. Oh, so in here, what I did was, so we did everything originally in flat space. So theta would actually be zero if I, or at least. Well, you can still have an expanding congruence in flat space, but at least these things would be zero. But then I, by hand, said, well, imagine that it was in a curved background. Then I would just put, for this, the derivative of this one, I just put the normal Ray Chaudhury equation. So when I differentiated this one, it's theta c dot plus theta q dot, and for theta c dot, I substituted the full thing, even though I didn't derive it that way. So it's, this part's... This piece here is sort of done by hand. And then theta q dot comes from differentiating, twice differentiating this area here. Okay? And when you differentiate twice, that t squared goes away. Okay, so.
Just one comment, perhaps. It would go against the sign that you would get from the quantum net energy condition, right? Because you have a minus r.
Oh, we're just going to talk about that. Okay. So let's first talk about the sign. So the sign here is the same as these signs. This is usually zero by hypersurface orthogonality. And so they're all the same sign. If the null energy condition is obeyed so that this is is positive, these are all the same sign. That's a bit disappointing because it means that the focusing theorem, which is a key ingredient in the singularity theorems and so on, is still obeyed by this quantum Ray Chaudhury equation. So all those results about singularities will still go through, even though now we've got quantum gravity, or at least at the linearized level. We might have hoped that quantum gravity will save us from singularities. But at least at this linearized level, it doesn't seem to help. It still has this minus sign. Okay. The other weird thing about this is the dependence on lambda. And lambda, I suggested, was given by the size of the system. If you had chosen a smaller subcongruence, so it's inversely proportional related to the size of the system. If you had chosen a smaller congruence, then lambda would have been bigger. Lambda is units of 1 over length. So if I had chosen a smaller one, the fluctuations would have been larger. The quantum area would have been larger. And so in such a way that the sum of the areas of the subcongruences would be greater than the areas of the whole congruence. So that's very strange. It looks like the total area depends on on the scale at which you measure it. And if you think about it, that's actually similar to how a coastline behaves. Like if you want to measure what is the length of a coastline, it really depends on what your ruler size is. If you have a very small ruler, you'll see all the little deviations of the coastline, and so you'll get a much longer length than if you just took a more coarse grain measuring length. And so that property suggests that there's a kind of fractal nature of space-time if you include effects of quantum gravity. So this is very speculative, of course. Yes?
Can I ask you about evaporation?
Evaporation?
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact is that RABUAUB that you have there, I mean, at the quantum level, it can become negative, right? So it can defocus. If you use the quantum net energy condition for matter fields, it defocuses.
Yes.
And it looks like your gravitational terms want you to refocus.
Yes.
Term.
Yes.
So, what are the effects of the extra term if the black hole start to evaporate and this applies to the black hole event horizon?
Great question. I don't know.
Impairs or does it reduce or impairs creation?
I haven't thought about any of those issues. So you're basically suggesting that if we flip the sign of this by quantizing matter, there may be a competition between the two.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting question. Okay, I think last year was the 100th centennial of Ray Chaudhury, so I think this will be on that note, it'll be a good note to end on, and here's my summary slide. We saw that generically, the quantum fluctuations of space-time produce noise in the deviation of particles. They turn this into a stochastic Langevin-like equation. The characteristics of the noise depend on the quantum state psi of gravity in a measurable way, in a calculable way. For a squeeze state, the enhanced noise might even be observable because of an exponential enhancement in the power spectrum. And detectors with very high frequency sensitivity, because this is bounded by omega max, might be able to detect enhanced correlated noise with a linear power spectrum during the merger phase of black holes. That would be where I would go. And finally, the noise adds a quantum term to the Ray Chaudhury equation, which generically is negative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe we'll take first question from the room.
Lee, I'll give you the mic in a second. Further questions? Simone, yes?
Yes, I wanted to hear your opinion about the, you said that at least at this level you found that the equivalence principle was still preserved. But there are these other calculations by Donohue in which he sees that there is a spin dependence on the geodesic equation for particles, which on the other hand is completely at a breaking of the equivalence principle. So I was wondering if you, maybe you might just say that things are compatible because you're only looking at scalar particles here.
Yeah, I mean,
do you have any insight over whether like this is compatible with your analysis or whether there could be?
So you would then have to take some Fermi-Walker type of equation, or right? Or what is, if you have a spin?
Well, do effective theory with of quantum gravity like you're doing.
Yeah.
But decouple and then, fermions and spin one particles.
Yeah.
And they see that at the same order, which are looking at the noise effect, in the geodesic equation, I think you were looking at Newton potential now, but let's say the geodesic equation, they have at that order a correction that is spin dependent.
Yeah.
So it's a breaking of the equivalence principle.
Yeah, maybe. That would be interesting. Yeah. That would, my interpretation of this would suggest that wouldn't happen, but, you know, it is what it is. Right?
So it's not obvious that they are compatible. Results.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just an interpretation. I just noticed that all the M's are there, and based on that, you can cancel them. Maybe the masses will still drop out, but maybe there's still some residual term that depends on the spin, in which case you would violate
the
equivalence principle. Yeah.
So if I'm not mistaken, you expanded ksi into ksi naught and higher order terms.
Which one?
The ksi.
The psi? Yeah.
So you expanded it into ksi naught and higher order terms, and you only took into account the ksi naught. And you. So I'm just a little bit confused. How do you say that you have quantized the area itself? Because is it based on the expansion of the ksi itself? Or?
Yes. So we're not measuring. So what we're not doing is considering the area as a metric proper quantity. What we're doing instead is using a bundle of geodesics and looking at how their area changes through their geodesic deviations. So you could have imagined that the area is just given by, integral of the determinant of the metric or something like that over some two section or something. That would be a geometric way of calculating the area. And maybe that gives the same thing, I don't know. But
so the areas are quantized itself? That is why I don't know.
Here we quantized the metric, and then we integrated out the metric to look at the behavior of the geodesics. Okay? And then from the geodesics, so we took a geodesics of a congruence with a certain initial area, and we saw that because they're coupled to a quantum fluctuating metric, they inherit fluctuations in their own areas, and then we calculated those areas.
So the waves that we observe in lambda, they should be very small too, because they're in the quantas of space, right?
The what?
The lambda that you have in
yes.
the equation. So we're measuring them in those quantas of space.
I would say that if we're looking at a bundle of rays, then lambda would be inversely related to the size of that bundle.
Okay, thank you.
Josh? I'm just wondering, is there a statistical mechanics interpretation of the corrected area, like to do with baroentropy or something like that?
That's a great question. So, of course, there's a great literature in which you can take even local congruences and, you know, from ideas of Jacobson and interpret them entropically, and then there's a and then you get the local, a kind of local first law. All of those just use classical GR, right, and then interpret that thermodynamically. Here we have gone a step further and quantized it, so we are allowing fluctuations. So maybe those will look like departures from equilibrium in the thermodynamic sense. It's a great question. I don't know what it is.
I may follow up on that. There is a recent, very recent paper by Stefan Hollands with Bob Wald and Zhang,
okay,
in which they show that if you have a dynamical horizon, you can compute a correction to the entropy. They call this new notion dynamical entropy. And the correction to the
yes.
entropy is negative in sign. So the area is becoming smaller due to temporal dependency of your background.
Right.
And essentially, instead of computing the entropy, instead of being related to the area of the event horizon, gets related to the area of the apparent horizon.
Uh-huh.
Slightly smaller in the moment in which matter
yes.
In falling cross.
Yeah.
Inside.
But that's still that's still classical. What they do there, yeah. But what they do there is basically they extend Wald's calculation of entropy to a place to a non-equilibrium situation.
To a more non-equilibrium.
Yeah.
But it looks
yeah.
like this non-equilibrium
yes.
is correcting the same sign.
Yes.
You are correct
yeah.
from these quantum effects.
Right.
Just was the follow-up call.
Yeah.
One other completely unrelated question, which was. Do these kinds of effects distinguish a fundamentally quantum gravity from a fundamentally classical but stochastic gravity?
I don't think you can. That's a very good question. I don't think you can say this is a smoking gun for quantum effects. If you were really, really pushed me to say, well, does this prove that gravity is quantized? I don't think the answer is yes. I think you can mimic all this in stochastic gravity. And that's not so surprising because in the way you get stochastic gravity is actually quite similar. You can get a kind of Langevin-Einstein equation and so on from basically the whole Feynman-Wernand prescription. So I don't know if they're if they can be truly distinguished. The same question is true in electrodynamics. I mean, to really show that electromagnetic field is quantized. You can't just show that they're random fluctuations because those could be stochastic electric magnetic fields, right? You'd have to prove something like sub-Poissonian statistics, which cannot be mimicked by classical stochastics. That's a smoking, and that requires very special states. Those are the states which would give the least noise. If you get very low amount of noise, but those would be impossible to measure for us.
So just following up on that, so coming from a background in quantum foundations, I think of a quantum signature as being something like interference when you have superposition or violation of Bell's inequalities when you have entanglement. So when you said that the signature of quantum theory is noise, I was sort of disappointed. I was hoping you were going to say that it was one of those things. And is that something that you, like when you take that limit, the classical limit, is that something you lose? Is it something that's in there in the math, but you sort of you take a limit away from it, or is it just not something you can expect to see in this kind of situation?
What would you not expect to see?
Interference or entanglement.
Oh yeah, certainly. For example, to see things like Bell's inequalities, you need to prepare certain states, right? It's not just. You know, you may have to look at a GHZ state or whatever and do experiments on those. If we were given such states, we would be able to do other kinds of experiments that would really say, well, this cannot possibly be a classical signal. So what I mean by the signal of quantum gravity is the noise. I don't mean that from a logical point of view, there would be some signal that could not have a classical explanation, just like Bell's inequalities don't. I just mean that there would be a feature that would be distinguishable from what you would normally get from classical physics.
You did a quantum calculation, you evolved a state and you
yeah.
did a measurement at the end, and so that kind of situation could lead to a violation of Bell's inequalities or observation of interference, but you didn't talk about it in your case.
So I'm not sure exactly what kind of experiment you would have to do to we're at a much more primitive level here, right? Because we haven't seen any sign of quantum. This is just like seeing the first glimpses of quantum mechanics before we can, and that comes before we can say that this, you know.
Are you familiar with this sort of proposal of Sagata bones and molecular
yes.
role.
Yes.
They have also two masses, but they go for interferometers and
yes.
interferons.
Yes.
Rotationally.
I was just talking to Ka.
That's a very different effect, I guess. Like
yes, I was just talking to Carlo Rovelli about that yesterday. I was a little confused about whether that was truly a quantum gravitational effect or whether it was quantum mechanics in the presence of Newtonian gravity. It's still not completely clear on what it is.
There is a question online. I think, Lee, you are still waiting, perhaps. I don't know. Do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Please.
I'm not muted. Good. This is a beautiful talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to the beginning of your talk, where you derived the classical theory and reduced it. Did you ever think of doing that in the first order form, where the separation between the metric and the connection variables depends, stays with the theory until you find the equation of motion? It seems at least that that would give you that would get rid of the higher order derivatives that you have to deal with in sort of ways.
Sorry, where did you want me to go?
The beginning of your talk when you derived the quantum Langevin equation.
The quantum Langevin
right.
equation. Okay.
So
yeah.
So go back to your action.
Okay.
So your action. So go back to your action. Good. So your action would depend on the metric and the connection variables separately.
Yes.
And I think if you were careful with that, you could find new kinds of effects, which wouldn't be non-classical effects, in the sense that you could leave to the very last step, and in the construction of the quantum theory, the separation of the metric and connection variables. And that would give you a possibility of studying something like torsion and spin at the level of the way down at the level of this quantum geodesic.
Right. Yeah, that's great. You're right, absolutely right. I think there are ways to extend this in formal directions like that. Specifically, there's another issue that I wanted to point out, which I don't know if this is related to that, but so we got this Langevin equation by taking a saddle point, but the saddle point is over a double path integral. So normally we get a saddle point over one path integral. And if there's a double one, then we get two different equations in principle, one for xi and one for xi prime. Here we set them equal to each other and we just solved it. But in principle, there could be some two separate equations, one going forward in time, one going backward in time, or something. I don't even know how to interpret it, but I think there's a richness to this that still needs to be explored on a formal level. We were just trying to get to an observable effect, but I also think that the torsion idea is very interesting.
Yes. Great, thank you.
I actually might have one very quick last question, perhaps. It's related to what we were discussing. You were insisting on the fact that this noise is correlated in a very particular way, and this 4.7 angle. What if you measure something? Can you measure some sort of entanglement between the two arms far away, which would mean more like of an entanglement measure that you can make something fall in some particular state for the other arm? Is there some measure of that sort that you can think of doing? The fact that this noise is correlated in this very specific way can therefore make you, maybe more toward entanglement rather than just...
So here we're working with probabilities, not amplitudes. Right. So all the richness of quantum mechanics is in things like amplitudes and states, and not in... Once we reduce it to probabilities, we've sort of lost a lot of that.
That's true.
You measure probabilities when you evaluate Bell's inequalities, you're measuring probabilities. So
you could still compare. That's true. You are measuring probabilities. Okay, so maybe I'll take that back. Yeah. Right. So you're asking whether if I measure, if I have two different...
Yeah, a different set of three arms,
yes,
right? The one in which it's a 1-2 and the tilted one. And I measure that the correlation between two is zero there, but maybe it's not zero there.
I see, see.
Can I
see. Oh, maybe there's a Bell's version of something. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. I don't know.
I have no idea what the answer would be.
That could not be explained by any classical...
I'm not even sure it can be done. I'm just wondering.
I think we've just sort of, I think the takeaway here is that we can do quantum gravity in flat space, and there's interesting things to learn. And most of that interesting things comes from the fact that there's possibility of unusual states, and also from effects of, you know, we don't have to measure single gravitons and things like that. We can, there are things we can still potentially measure.
You've got squeeze states being prepared when you have intense gravitational fields. And
yes.
Squeeze states are entangled. It depends on how you define entangled.
What do you mean?
I'm not sure. Like in a quantum optical sense, if a squeeze state hits a beam split, the state that comes out is entangled. I'm not sure that's a relevant fact in this case, but it's.
But that's only because it went.
The state in the same coherent state.
Yes, absolutely not. Yeah, it's still minimum uncertainty, but it can't be described by anything classical. In fact, I ended up reading a lot of the quantum optics literature, and there's Glauber papers and these amazing classic papers to understand this. Yeah.
All right. Let's thank again, Malik.
Thank you.